KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
From NPR News in Washington, D.C., this is Weekend Edition. I'm Scott Simon. In this hour, Don Gagne on the week in politics. And later, Peter McPherson, the USAID director under President Reagan, on what he sees as the cost of cutting U.S. assistance around the world. Also, Super Bowl LAX, as they say it in Roman numerals, Chiefs and Eagles and pharmaceutical commercials. Oh, my. And then Love Among the Leaves.
Tarzan, what am I doing here? Alone? With you?
Marino Sullivan, Tarzan the Ape Man, 1932. We speak to Ken Turan on his new book on the studio duo, Thalberg and Mayer, who made the MGM lion roar. First, our newscast. It's Saturday, February 8, 2025.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Nora Rahm. A federal judge in New York issued an emergency order early this morning blocking billionaire Elon Musk and his associates from accessing Treasury Department records. Attorneys general from 19 states had sued, led by Letitia James of New York. She says the private information of millions of Americans is at risk, including tax returns and Social Security numbers.
This unelected group, led by the world's richest man, is not authorized to have this information. And they explicitly sought this unauthorized access to illegally block payments that millions of Americans rely on. Payments for health care, child care, and other essential programs.
The order remains in effect until a hearing on Friday. Federal workers will have the weekend to mull over a Trump administration proposal that they resign now but be paid through September. As Frank Morris of member station KCUR reports, while 4 out of 5 federal workers live in the D.C. area, it's not just Washington that's affected.
In Kansas City, the federal government is by far the largest employer, with close to 30,000 employees, including for the IRS, EPA, and Social Security Administration. Elon Musk is trying to slash the federal workforce. He's targeting an immediate 10% cut. Economist Frank Link with the Mid-America Regional Council says that in Kansas City, that would be almost as bad as losing a major auto assembly plant.
Overall, for every federal job, there's another job created in the metro. So they're powerful jobs from that standpoint.
The buyout offer is tied up in court, at least until Monday. For NPR News, I'm Frank Morris in Kansas City.
The Trump administration wants Congress to provide more money for detaining and deporting people suspected of being in the country without authorization. NPR's Jimena Bastillo reports.
Since the start of the Trump administration, officials say they have arrested over 8,000 people, but not all have been held in detention. Press Secretary Caroline Levitt told reporters at the White House this week that over 400 people that were arrested by federal immigration officials have already been released.
Some of the factors include a lack of significant likelihood of removal in the foreseeable future, lack of detention availability, which is something this president and this administration has been incredibly vocal about.
She added that some had serious medical conditions and none have had final deportation orders. The lead agency in charge of stopping illegal immigration, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, has long warned that it may not have enough physical space to handle Trump's efforts to ramp up enforcement. Jimena Bustillo, NPR News, Washington.
Hamas and Israel are conducting another hostage prisoner exchange today under the ceasefire deal that began last month. Hamas released 3 men who had been held hostage since the war began. Israel is releasing more than 180 Palestinian prisoners and detainees. This is NPR News. Rescuers in southwestern China are searching for at least 30 people missing after a landslide. It struck a village in Sichuan province, burying 10 houses. Officials say 2 people were pulled from the rubble alive. Super Bowl fans are arriving in New Orleans ahead of the big game tomorrow. More than 100,000 people are expected in town this weekend. Matt Bloom with member station WWNO reports many are noticing beefed-up security.
On Bourbon Street, the state has installed new metal barricades to block cars at every intersection. No coolers or large bags are allowed. It's a step up from the usual measures here, but fans like Danae Moreno from Philadelphia appreciate it.
It definitely seems like there's more of a presence, and I think because of It looks a little more than I saw in Vegas or even Arizona, because we happen to go to both the last couple years.
Security upgrades came after a driver intentionally plowed into a Bourbon Street crowd early New Year's Day, killing 14 people and injuring dozens. More than 2,000 officers from various agencies are deployed. They're visible on almost every street corner. For NPR News, I'm Matt Bloom in New Orleans.
Sony's PlayStation Network went dark last night, affecting gamers around the world. They can't access online services, stores, and multimedia apps. The company says it is aware of the issue and is working to resolve it. Users are still able to play offline games, but they can't access the online aspects of games such as Call of Duty and Grand Theft Auto. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people, and the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Thank you for being with us. Cascade of headlines on the third weekend of President Trump's second term in office. Where to begin? A federal judge early today blocked Elon Musk's Department of Government Efficiency, DOGE, from getting access to Treasury Department records containing sensitive personal data for millions of Americans. Earlier in the week, another judge temporarily curbed the president's efforts to put USAID employees on leave. President Trump has also put a close ally in charge of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. Joined now by NPR national political correspondent Don Gagne in Detroit. Don, thanks so much for being with us.
I am glad to be here. Hi.
Where to start? You first.
Boy, you use the word cascade. Maybe we could say a fire hose. That's the one I use a lot. We expected a lot of aggressive action from the Trump administration right from the jump, because that's what they told us they would do. And we really are in a place where the fire hose is turned on. And every day, as you said, it is multiple big things.
It's been less than 2 weeks since over 2 million federal employees received an email telling them they could resign by February 6 or stay in those positions without any assurances they would have a job. That deadline's been pushed to Monday, but where do things seem to stand now?
Now we get the legal battles. A judge ruled that the White House could not do what it did, that there are so many questions unresolved about who has the authority to cut these jobs, where the funding to pay workers through September, as proposed for some, would come from. So look for direction from the courts, but that may not stop the administration. And now on top of this comes the judge's order regarding Treasury Department data overnight, data on individual citizens. We are going to see a lot of this. And we still don't know if or how the White House will view orders that they comply with the courts.
Of course, in Detroit, you are on the Canadian border. How have President Trump's threats to place steep tariffs on Canadian goods being received in Canada, even as talks continue?
And those tariffs were set to go in place this past week. The White House called a 30-day pause on all of that. But yes, the threat really does still exist. And economists will tell you that the tariffs would be very destructive to economies on both sides of the border. Detroit, Windsor, that's the city right across the Detroit River, is the nation's busiest border crossing. Automobile parts flow across that border. Production schedules depend on that. Tens of thousands of jobs depend on that. There are civic and business partnerships of all kinds across the Detroit River, and all of that's just the start of it. So nobody has relaxed at all.
Tuesday, while meeting with Prime Minister Netanyahu, President Trump had this to say about the future of the Gaza Strip.
We have an opportunity to do something that could be phenomenal. And I don't want to be cute. I don't want to be a wise guy. But the Riviera of the Middle East, this could be something that could be so bad. This could be so magnificent.
Don, you, of course, have been reporting in the Arab American community in Dearborn, Michigan. What reaction has there been there?
Dearborn is a majority Arab American city. Biden won big there in 2020. But this last election, it was close, but it went for Trump, largely because of anger over the war in Gaza and the Biden administration's support for Israel. Again, it's not that these voters had great hopes for Trump, but they did seem caught off guard by remarks like what we just heard. People, to me, expressed offense, no matter how they voted, offended at Trump saying Gaza would be taken over by the U.S., offended at the call to relocate Gaza's population, offended at the reference to it as a future Riviera. And there has been, Scott, some finger-pointing and blaming those who voted for Trump, but also even toward those who abstained, maybe stayed uncommitted. So it has been a difficult week in places like Dearborn, Michigan.
And NPR's Don Gagne, thanks so much for being with us.
It's a pleasure. Thanks, Scott.
Fighting and violence continue in a region of the Democratic Republic of Congo. Nearly February, 3,000 people were killed in Goma, a city of 2 million, in just a few days. A rebel force backed by troops from neighboring Rwanda took control of Goma, and they are now threatening to march on the Congolese capital. Emmett Livingstone joins us now from Goma. Emmett, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Of course, this is a conflict between Congolese fighters and this rebel force, the March 23 movement, or M23. What is Goma like under rebel control?
Well, life at the moment is slowly getting back to normal in Goma. There are cars on the streets. Shops are opening at least for part of the day. And of course, M23 fighters are posted around the city. But there's still a sense of foreboding. Lots of people aren't venturing out at night. And many people I've spoken to say that they fear the M23, which has begun imposing a parallel government in the city. Every Saturday, for example, people are now forced out into the streets to clean them up. This is a traditional practice in the region, but it's rarely enforced. Most people are obeying, so they told me, because they're afraid of the consequences.
Help us understand this region better. It has a vast supply of critical minerals, doesn't it?
It does. So Congo in general has a vast supply of critical minerals. It's most notable for its cobalt supplies, but which is far away from this region around Goma. The minerals that are most prevalent here and most of interest internationally are coltan, which is mined in the region and which is used in the manufacture of electronic products. That said, there's a narrative that this conflict is all about minerals, but it's much more complicated than that. It's probably one factor among many. Seizing Goma, for example, has no obvious benefit for the minerals trade.
Well, how serious then is M23's threat to march on the capital, Kinshasa?
In a word, serious, but for the moment, it's probably a long way off. The thing to bear in mind is that the M23 isn't simply an armed group. It's supported by the Rwandan army, which is one of the most capable in sub-Saharan Africa. And if you compare it with the Congolese army, there's really no comparison at all. That army has been devastated by corruption for years. And to give you a flavor, Congolese soldiers are paid about $100 a month, if they're paid at all. But how far the M23 and Rwanda will go really depends on the political context. Unless there are serious concessions from Congo, or unless there's very serious pushback internationally, this conflict will likely keep going.
So no prospect of a ceasefire at the moment?
The M23 declared a unilateral ceasefire, but it's important to understand that this was unilateral. The Congolese government never agreed to it, and it very, very quickly broke down. I think within a day or two, fighting had started again, and the M23 started pushing in the neighboring province of South Kivu.
And what's the humanitarian situation like there in Goma, Emmett?
Well, it's been devastating. If you scroll back a few years, the rebels had kept Goma under siege for 2 years, and nearly 800,000 displaced people were living in squatter camps around the city. And these camps, they were filled with hunger and violence and disease. And then the capture of the city itself came, and that was brutally violent. And the latest figures we have put the death toll at about 3,000 people. If you think about it, this number is absolutely staggering. We're talking about 3,000 people killed over the course of a few days.
Reporter Emmett Livingstone in Goma, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Shortly after Donald Trump's inauguration, Taiwan's opposition-controlled legislature voted to reduce defense spending. Meanwhile, the Chinese threat seems to grow more serious, and the question of whether the U.S. would come to Taiwan's assistance gets less clear. Ashish Valentine reports from Taipei.
Rival lawmakers yelled over each other as the opposition parties pushed spending cuts to nearly immediate votes. In total, they froze or cut over $6 billion U.S. dollars from President Lai Ching-te's proposed budget. Many of those reductions hit the military and its purchases of U.S. equipment. Chen Liangzhi is a researcher at a defense think tank funded by Taiwan's government. He thinks the reductions would make it harder to keep up with the jets and ships China constantly deploys around Taiwan.
For Taiwanese Air Force, the jet has to scramble every day. So without that kind of operational expense, you cannot purchase oil, any kind of maintenance equipment.
Chinese aircraft crossed near Taiwan over 3,000 times last year, according to figures from Taiwan's defense ministry. Legislator with the ruling Democratic Progressive Party, Chen Guanding, worries that as tensions with China rise, Taiwan needs to be careful about the signals it sends the U.S.
Cutting the defense budget will send a wrong message to our allies, especially to the United States, right, that Taiwan might not be serious to our defense development.
Complicating the situation for Taiwan's ruling party, President Trump remains less clear than his predecessor about defending Taiwan. Here's what he told NBC News weeks before his inauguration.
If China invades Taiwan on your watch, are you committed to defending Taiwan?
I never say.
Still won't say.
I never say because I have to negotiate things, right?
Alexandra Huang is Director of International Affairs for the opposition KMT, which helped pass these reductions. He says the opposition might release some of the funds if the ruling party can prove it's necessary.
We support stronger defense, but quietly. We do not use our military collaboration with the United States to poke Beijing's eyes.
With uncertainty from the U.S. on one side and escalating threats from China on the other, Taiwan finds itself threading the needle yet again in an ever riskier geopolitical climate. For NPR News, I'm Ashish Valentine in Taipei.
You're listening to NPR News.
I'm Noor Rahm with these headlines. The Palestinian militant group Hamas released three more hostages today who had been held since the attack on Israel in October of 2023, which started the war in Gaza. In exchange, Israel is releasing more than 180 Palestinian prisoners or detainees. Lebanon formed a new government today, the country's first full-fledged government in 2 years. It's trying to rebuild after the war between Israel and the Hezbollah militant group that ended in November. And recovery efforts are underway in western Alaska after a commuter plane crashed this week. It went down Thursday afternoon in a flight to Nome. All 10 people on board were killed. I'm Noor Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy and helping clients find balance. Clients are matched with one of 30,000 therapists for online therapy from anywhere at betterhelp.com/public. From Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, at wtgrantfdn.org.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. President Trump's efforts to dismantle the U.S. Agency for International Development were dealt a setback yesterday when a federal judge temporarily blocked the administration's order to put more than 2,000 of its employees on leave. Now, this injunction is temporary. Future of the agency President Trump has called wasteful and corrupt remains in doubt. It is also a target of Elon Musk, who has called USAID, quote, a viper's nest of radical left Marxists who hate America. But others contend the organization's been a leader when it comes to distributing food and curing diseases and promoting democracy, and shutting it down would hurt U.S. interests. Peter McPherson ran USAID under President Ronald Reagan. He's also the former chairman of Dow Jones and joins us in our studios. Mr. McPherson, thanks so much for being with us.
Good morning. Good to be here.
The voters elected President Trump to cut spending and put America first, as he said. Why shouldn't USAID be part of the effort to rein in spending?
Well, I think President Trump will find that AID is an important instrument for U.S. foreign policy, and that he will find this very important. Reagan, in fact, increased the amount of foreign aid, which is now less than 1% of the federal government budget. We're in this competition with China all over the world, and AID is an important instrument for dealing with in this whole competition. I think the Reagan administration, I think other administrations have found that AID was responsive and should be responsive to the foreign policy of the administration. I believe that that President Trump can find it to be such as well.
The annual budget is $40 billion, which is more than it, I'm guessing it was under your stewardship when you were administrator of USAID. Is there a case to be made that any agency of this size that spends that amount of money could be a target for reform?
Well, I think every government agency should be looked at carefully in terms of expenditures. In fact, as administrator, not longer after I got there, I returned to the U.S. Treasury $28 million of projects I thought were inefficient. In fact, Reagan thought it was such a great idea. He had me over to the White House for a press conference where I gave him a big check that was on the front pages of the papers all over this country. And later on, we had the authority to reallocate money to be more efficient, to focus on some key things. That authority is there, and I'm sure that President Trump will want to do that as well.
Let me pose it to you in a different way. Why should the U.S. be the largest funder of food and health programs in the world? Wouldn't it be better for the world if other countries had to step up and meet humanitarian obligations?
Well, other countries, in fact, do provide huge amounts of assistance. Back in the 80s, most weren't, but in the years since, there's a substantial amount of monies from Europe, from Japan, other countries. I think it's important that others do. The disasters, for example, I was involved in a famine deeply in Ethiopia, and I went to those camps and saw those starving children.
I was there and covered that, and I will never forget seeing the bags that said "Gift of the American People."
Exactly, it's important in terms of food production around the world, including the research to work on crops that poor people eat. We do important work. It's important to see that, for example, bugs, viruses have no borders, and diseases in one place go around the world. It's important to see that we don't, failed states can be sources of terrorism and disease and so forth. We need to help the world to help ourselves.
If you're a Republican, what would you tell President Trump?
this agency will respond to the policies that you wish. That was certainly true under President Reagan. You will find it a very important tool that will be helpful to you, and you need to look at these projects carefully. Secretary Rubio has commented recently about that to the Guatemala embassy, and I hope that policy approaches pursuit.
Peter McPherson, former administrator of USAID under President Reagan, thanks so much. For some customers using a telehealth website to get cheaper versions of obesity drugs, the low prices turned out to be too good to be true. And now they aren't sure what to do after learning that the pharmacy that made their medicine was operating without the right license. NPR pharmaceutical correspondent Sydney Lupkin reports.
When Lara Franzese's regular doctor wouldn't write her a prescription for an obesity drug to help her lose weight, she decided to try a local medical spa. The spa offered a range of services, including obesity medicines. By the numbers, she was obese and hadn't been able to lose weight on her own. A nurse at the med spa offered her 16 weeks of compounded tirzepatide, which is the active ingredient in Eli Lilly's Zepbound. Compounded drugs aren't generics, but rather they're made by specialized pharmacies, which are allowed to essentially make copies during drug shortages.
And over those 16 weeks, I lost 20 pounds. And it was life-changing that this medicine was giving me something that my body clearly needed.
But it was expensive, and she soon discovered she could get a better price from a telehealth provider called Zappy Health. She bought a 3-month supply of the medicine through Zappy in December for around $1,000. Her supply came from a compounding pharmacy called Usha Pharmacy, but Zappy uses other pharmacies too. Eric Bishop, an IT professional in Salt Lake City, Utah, says he wasn't told his order would come from Usha until after he had paid Zappy.
Zappy didn't tell me that. Until I got basically a little thing and said, your medication's going to come from USA, but they didn't give me a choice.
But there was a problem. On December 5th, the Florida Department of Public Health filed a complaint against USHA, which is based in Florida. It said USHA was compounding without a sterile compounding license, improperly storing medicines that needed to be refrigerated, and failing to document drugs it dispensed. USHA didn't respond to multiple requests for comment for this story. A statement on Zappy's website said it has ceased its relationship with USHA. Zappy declined to comment for this story. In Utah, Bishop had just gotten nearly $3,000 worth of vials when he heard about the problem with USHA's license.
I'm all of a sudden, you know, about ready to start taking my medication. I'm like, I now no longer have any confidence in what I have. And I'm like, I either want my money back or I want a replacement for what I have because I don't trust what I have.
On January 31st, USHA voluntarily relinquished the regular pharmacy license it did have. The pharmacy's phone number goes to voicemail, and its website is down. That leaves Franzese and other customers with tough choices. They could throw out their stockpiles or use the medicine anyway and risk that it doesn't work or is contaminated. Scott Bruner, the CEO of the Alliance for Pharmacy Compounding, says not having a sterile compounding license is egregious.
I would not take a drug that has been dispensed to that patient from a pharmacy that has been found to be in violation of its state license law.
He says this situation is unfortunate for the patients involved, but it's an example of the regulatory system working the way it's supposed to. USHA Pharmacy wasn't a member of his trade group. The National Association of Boards of Pharmacy say it's hard to know how many online retailers are offering compounded obesity drugs that are made without the proper license or registration. Still, Betty Jones, who works on accreditation and inspection at the association, says consumers can be on the lookout for red flags. For instance, you should always know what pharmacy is filling your prescription, and they're required to provide counseling.
If they're not providing you that offer of patient counseling, or you're calling into that pharmacy and they don't allow you to, you know, be progressed to a pharmacist so that way you can ask questions, that would be something that I would call a red flag.
She says prices that are too low and pharmacies that don't ask for a prescription should also raise alarm bells. Now Zappi customers are trying to get their money back. Bishop, the Zappi customer in Utah, runs a Facebook group of 500 people to help them with credit card disputes after they say Zappi refused to offer refunds.
We're just a community just kind of helping each other out.
Zappi is still advertising to customers, but Bishop isn't buying from them again. He's back on compounded tirzepatide from his local brick and mortar pharmacy. Sydney Lupkin, NPR News.
And now it's time for sports. The Chiefs play for history, the Eagles for revenge, and I get to use my sports doofus voice. A flurry, by the way, of big name trades in pro basketball. Howard Bryant of Better Lark Media joins us. Howard, thanks for being with us.
Good morning, Scott. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks, my friend. Super Bowl, of course, tomorrow in New Orleans. Kansas City Chiefs going for their third straight title. No team in NFL history has been able to win three Super Bowls in a row. In fact, they began that string 2 years ago by defeating the Philadelphia Eagles, who they coincidentally play tomorrow. Revenge time. What'll be the key to the game?
Well, I think the key to the game is going to be what all football games come down to, especially in the playoffs, injuries and turnovers. And that's always the battle. And if you can, if you protect the football and you play your game, you've got a really good shot to win. But, you know, games really steamroll when you go out there and you make a ton of mistakes. And then all of a sudden you're wondering why you're in the bad situation you're in. But obviously the Chiefs are a great, great football team. They haven't even really been that good this year. You've watched them all year and wondered why they've been this. And then here they are at the Super Bowl again. So this is going to be a great battle. Both teams heavily motivated to come out on top.
That's it. That, I mean, maybe it's a cliche, but that defines a great team, doesn't it? They can play not up to their best and still win.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's true. And part of it is the difficulty of repeating and then repeating and then obviously repeating again. We've never seen it before. There are so many other things that get in the way, egos and money and boredom and pain and all of the things. Yeah. But this team just has, they've got the best quarterback, they've got the best coach, and they've got a really, really good defense as well.
I have to ask, what do you make of this, what I'll call conspiracy theory, that seems to have taken hold of so many NFL fans that the league is tipping the scales in favor of the Chiefs?
I think it's extremely dangerous, and I think there's a lot of truth to it when you look at the statistics. The NFL has come out and said it was ridiculous. The NFL Referees Association said it was ridiculous. But you look at the disparity of the penalties, you look at the timeliness of some of these things, and I get it. But I really think, Scott, the biggest thing here is we know across the board this is a very cynical time in this country. It's a very cynical time in every element of our lives. And I think that this is also one of the great byproducts, the unintended consequences of these professional sports, especially football, went in 1,000% on gambling. And when you give your sport away to speculation, people don't trust what they're watching anymore. And every other commercial is a gambling commercial. Every other statistic is to sort of get you to make some sort of prop bet. And obviously the end result of that is people questioning the end result. Sports is all we have when it comes to the unscripted competition. If it's not real, if it doesn't feel real, the game has a huge problem. And that is a piece of what's happening now.
I have to ask you about the NBA this week. At the trade deadline, a triple team trade between the LA Lakers, Dallas Mavericks, and Utah Jazz being called one of the most shocking trades in NBA history. How so?
Oh, you don't see superstars at that level get traded for each other. And certainly when one of them is a 25-year-old Luka Doncic, who's considered one of the great, great players in the NBA and one of the great, you know, cornerstones of the Dallas franchise. And I think that when you have that, especially Luka, who took his team to the NBA Finals less than a year ago, then the Dallas Mavericks are sending a message that they don't like what they see in terms of his work ethic. They didn't like what they see in terms of his defense. They certainly didn't like what they saw. That you would take a cornerstone player and say, we don't think we can win with you, even though we were at the NBA Finals last year.
Yeah. Howard, one last question. Tomorrow, nachos, pizza, or tofu cubes?
Always take pizza over everything.
All
it's
right.
just... the way it has to be, even at Super Bowl parties.
All right, with your advice. Howard Bryant of Meadowlark Media, thanks so much. Happy Super Bowl. Good to be with you, my friend. Talk to you soon.
Thank you, Scott.
And you're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. Ever bite into a luscious-looking apple only to be rewarded with, a chunk of mealy pulp? Turns out that other creatures, including BJ Lederman, who does our theme music, associate the texture of food with taste, and that includes fruit fly maggots. Science reporter Ari Daniel explains.
The persimmon was Nikita Komarov's favorite fruit when he was growing up in Moscow.
When they are properly ripe, they're delicious and sweet and soft.
Just before that, though, they're wretched. Komarov, who's a neurobiology PhD student at the University of Freiburg in Switzerland, says taste signals take a bit of time to register in the brain.
Whereas with physical attributes of food, for example, texture, this is an instant form of feedback when we put something in our mouth before we even perceive what we're tasting.
This sense of mouthfeel,
is it crunchy, is it soft, is it chewy, is it gooey,
gives important information about food safety and quality, helping avoid eating something that might be dangerous. But actually, very little is known about how animals perceive food texture. So Komarov and his colleagues turned to study the phenomenon in a species that's easy to manipulate, fruit flies, specifically the larva.
It eats constantly, so it really, really, really cares about food.
The question was, which aspects of rotting fruit do these maggots like and dislike? First, Komarov engineered larvae without their taste organ, while leaving everything else about them untouched.
We gave the animals a choice between a harder and a softer substrate.
Normal larvae prefer to eat the softer substrate, the one that most resembles rotting fruit.
They are very, very picky.
But the larvae without the taste organ ate both offerings.
They suddenly stopped caring.
The only difference in the food was the texture, so Komarov suspected an intact taste organ also allows a larva to detect that delicious, not too hard, not too soft, rotting fruit texture, kind of like human tongues.
In the maggot, what was thought to be an exclusively taste organ is actually also a texture organ as well.
Texture, it turns out, is as important a signal to the maggot as how bitter or toxic a food is. Komarov then examined one of the neurons within the taste organ. He found it responds to sugar, acid, salt, and texture.
Seems to be a neuron that sort of does a little bit of everything.
Not all neurons, in other words, respond to just one thing and relay it up to the brain. It's way more complex.
The maggot perceives the food in this multidimensional space.
The research is published in the journal PLOS Biology.
This study could help us understand what drives pests to different crops and then how maybe that can be used to manage their influence on agriculture.
By creating texture-based traps, says Devasina Tyagarajan, a neurobiologist at the Max Planck Institute for Chemical Ecology who wasn't involved in the research. She adds that the findings go beyond just fruit flies.
Our understanding of what a fly larvae does is crucial in also, at some point in the future, understanding how more complex organisms execute similar functions.
That's a point Nikita Komarov agrees with. He hopes the work might one day provide insights into eating disorders among people.
Understanding the function of sensory cells is important in then evaluating how we perceive things and how that perception can go wrong.
And on the flip side, how to tweak the texture of foods, healthy or otherwise, to make them more palatable. For NPR News, I'm Ari Daniel.
This is NPR News.
Searching for her next project, filmmaker Dawn Porter met with some record execs.
They mentioned Luther and I was like, stop. There's no Luther Vandross documentary? What are you saying out loud?
Well, now there is. Luther Never Too Much. And we're going to play some Luther Vandross. Sunday on Weekend Edition from NPR News. I just don't want to stop.
much, never too much, never too much, never too much.
I'm Nora Rahm with these headlines. A federal judge has blocked Elon Musk and his team from getting access to Treasury Department systems that contain the personal and financial information of millions of Americans. The order is in effect until a hearing next week. President Trump says he is immediately revoking security clearances for former President Joe Biden, saying Biden set the precedent by taking away his clearances shortly after Trump left office. And leaders from Eastern and Southern Africa are meeting in Tanzania today to find a way to end the violence in the Democratic Republic of Congo. Thousands have died in fighting between government troops and rebels. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Progressive Insurance, working to help protect small businesses and the owners that run them, offering customizable coverages to salons, accounting firms, tradespeople, and more. Learn more at progressivecommercial.com. From the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. And from ECMC Foundation, at ecmcfoundation.org.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. They were the exemplary Mr. Inside and Mr. Outside. One was the proud son of a junk man. The other looked like, and in fact was often mistaken for, the office boy. But together, they made Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer the great Hollywood film factory of the 1920s through the 30s, turning out musicals that lifted the depression and epics that stirred hopes. Louis B. Mayer and Irving Thalberg, The Whole Equation, is the new book by Kenneth Turan, longtime critic for the Los Angeles Times and National Public Radio. It's part of the Yale Press's Jewish Live series. And Ken joins us now from our studios in Culver City, California. Thanks so much for being with us.
It's great to be here, Scott.
Louis B. Mayer, immigrant family from Ukraine, and his father's scrap metal business at the age of 12. How did he become a Hollywood mogul?
It's a very good question. I think sometimes he must have asked himself the same question because it's such an unlikely trajectory. But he kind of stumbled into the movie business, as many of the original moguls did. They were looking for anything that made money, and the movies were making money, even in their earliest days. And he turned out to have a gift for it. And, you know, for seven consecutive years, newspapers reported him as the man with the highest salary in the entire country.
And Irving Thalberg, born to a New York German-Jewish family and born with a congenital heart disease. He, I think at the age of 19, became a secretary in the film company. How did he rise so high so quickly?
Thalberg had this almost innate gift for story and for what audiences would like. The line is he ran Universal before he was old enough to sign the checks. He was just a phenomenon.
Let me ask you about some of the films they made. Ben-Hur, and I don't mean the Charlton Heston one. But Ben-Hur, A Tale of the Christ, a silent film, 1925, Ramon Navarro as Ben-Hur. Crowd scenes are amazing, aren't they?
They are. They're quite spectacular. I mean, even by today's standards, you look at them and you say, wow.
Because this was before CGI. How did they do it?
Well, they didn't have CGI, but they did it two ways. First of all, they did gather a lot of people. Great film historian Kevin Brownlow discovered this. They were very shrewd at finding things that they would place in front of the camera, special props that made it look like there were a lot of people. They could manipulate these things. Ultimately, they grabbed people off the streets close to where this was being filmed and said, you know, come inside and watch a movie.
Yeah. Anna Christie. I mean, what a gimmick. Garbo talks.
Give me a whiskey, ginger, and I'm sorry. I'm awfully stingy, baby. I shouldn't call it a gimmick, should I?
Yeah. Well, no. I mean, the gimmick is the ad campaign, Garbo Talks. There's a story that when Garbo met the man who came up with that line, she looked at him and said, "Aren't you ashamed?" Greta Garbo was a huge star at MGM in the silent era, and they were very careful about how they were going to transition her to sound. And Anna Christie, the O'Neill play, very celebrated play, it had been filmed once before, and it was about an immigrant. So the fact that she spoke accented English was exactly what was called for. So that's how they picked it, and it turned out to be a huge hit for her.
I have to ask about anti-Semitism in Hollywood, because there are some very prominent people. And I'm thinking now of a bishop of Los Angeles who did not like Hollywood films and blamed what they did on, and I'm going to quote the L.A. bishop, Jewish studio owners.
This was one of the surprises for me in researching the book. I mean, I always knew that there was some anti-Semitism in America at the time, but the extent of it and the extent of it as it applied to Mayer and Thalberg really surprised me. And Mayer and Thalberg, they just kind of shrugged it off. You know, this was business as usual for them. They weren't surprised by it. They weren't happy about it, but they just knew this was something they had to endure.
Another film I want to ask about. The sound of a Weekend Edition editorial meeting. Tarzan the Ape Man, played by Johnny Weissmuller, who will forever be the best-known graduate of Senn High School in Chicago. I say that as a Senn grad myself. This was a famous British novel that the studio put together, and what did they do? They created a franchise.
They created a huge franchise, you know, and it's a very interesting story because other people had made Tarzan movies before MGM, but Mayer and Thalberg didn't really care. They felt that their touch would make a difference and these other movies would just disappear into, you know, the cosmos, which is what happened.
And then Irving Thalberg, I think this is Ben Heck's phrase, caught cold and died, right?
Yes. 37. Yes. He had a heart condition. He was always frail. I mean, people thought that he would die young from, you know, when he was born. And it turned out he died of pneumonia. And, you know, at that period of time, just coming into use were what they call sulfa drugs, things like penicillin. Now, they were practically experimental drugs, but they were being used. But his wife, Norma Shearer, who was a big actress, she was uncertain. But finally, they voted no on the sulfa drugs, and Thalberg died, and she held herself responsible for a certain period of time. Even though everyone knew that he might die young, it still was a huge shock to Hollywood when he died.
It is painful to read about Louis B. Mayer's relationship with Judy Garland. On the one hand, they meant a lot to each other. On the other hand.
You know, that's it's a very sad. She wrote an autobiography in which she said, you know, it was not published, but Gerald Frank, who wrote this classic biography of her, uncovered this, you know, where she said that he would molest her. You know, he would say, you know, you sing from the heart, and he'd put his hand on her breast to kind of emphasize where the heart was. They had a really toxic relationship, even though they meant a lot to each other. It's really one of these puzzling relationships.
Did Thalberg and Mayer create what I'll call the American Dream Factory that became just part of what America is around the world to so many people?
I think so. I mean, there were key players in it. A lot of people, you know, helped contribute to it. Obviously, they wanted films to make money. They were not public servants. They wanted a profit. But they really believed that film could create a culture, could do good in the world. And they really, in a lot of their films, they attempted to do that. They felt that this was something movies could do.
Ken, I got to ask, you and a lot of other people in Southern California suffered a serious loss recently. What happened? How are you doing?
Well, you know, my house and everything in it, 40 years of things my wife and I have, you know, gathered together, they're all gone. And you try to move on because there's no other choice. That stuff is not coming back.
Kenneth Turan, his new book, Louis B. Mayer and Irving Thalberg, The Whole Equation. Thank you so much for being with us.
Scott, it's been a pleasure to talk to you, really.
If electric vehicles are the future is now in Norway. 9 out of 10 cars sold there are electric, which means the country is fast becoming a global test market for the EV industry. Later today in All Things Considered, how Norway became EV Nirvana. You can listen by telling your smart speaker to play your member station by name.
when you're married but also play in the same band, there's really no getting away from each other.
There's been times where we've had terrible fights before we go on stage. And then they announce us, and we go out, and we see a few hundred people, and we look at each other and go, all right, okay, Layla, I love you. Let's go do this thing.
For nearly a decade, Eric Lindberg and Donny Zastloff have performed in Nefesh Mountain, where they play music that includes all kinds of sounds, from bluegrass to folk to jazz, and they have just released a new album called Beacons that is influenced by current events but also contains a message of hope and optimism. Eric Lindberg, how's a nice guy from Brooklyn wind up playing bluegrass? Why not, I guess, but go ahead.
Well, that question is one of my favorites, and it's why I wrote that song, This Is Me, because I get it all the time. How did a nice Jewish boy, my grandma still calls me her Brooklyn boy, you know, how did I get into this stuff? And it found me somehow. I do have family down south in Georgia, which probably explains a good amount of it. But I've just been infatuated with this idea of the American landscape and American music, despite, of course, the pain in this country. And, you know, so much of what we know now today, it's just this country was built on so much pain, but there's so much beauty that came out of it. And I see it in the music.
Donny Zastloff, what drew you to this, to Americana music?
I think since I was just a little girl, I've just been just on fire from all kinds of music. I've just been a person who's had it in my soul. And I think this song means so much to us because it speaks to that music in our hearts and sort of how we ended up where we are and who we are.
Well, let me ask about who you are, because Nefesh Mountain, Nefesh is means soul or life in Hebrew, doesn't it?
Yes, it does.
Where do your faith and your music come together? How are they all wound up in each other?
These days especially, I actually think of them as being pretty separate. Whatever faith and spirituality that Donny and I have, I don't feel is always represented in our music. I feel like our music is very secular and very openly trying to be who we are as American folks and bluegrass musicians, also as Jewish folks. You know, so many of my heroes that I know are Jewish, I wish they spoke openly about it. You know, we see so much hate and anti-Semitism just out there in the world, and we just want to be open about it and put out positive messages of unity and healing as Jewish folks.
I have to ask you about one of your songs, Better Angels. We're only strangers who've yet to be friends, we'll be in pain too. We can make amends, these stubborn stains will come out in the end. Oh, Better Angels, unite us all again. This is following the October 7 attack by Hamas on Israel. Why did you want to write this song?
I think after October 7th, we didn't know what to do with ourselves, really. And we really just, you know, we're not politicians and we're not experts on this situation. We are musicians. And we kind of immediately decided, okay, we're going to just start putting out our music because that's really the only thing that we know how to do. You know, there's just so much negative going on right
now. She said, son and daughter, listen well. Don't you take all words to heart.
Both Eric and I have spent many times putting videos, shouting into the phone, saying things, but realizing that that's not going to help the world at all if we just start putting out more negative and more yelling and more anger. And so this song in particular was an attempt to try to remind ourselves that we do have better angels and that we can, even in this country, you know, to try to find a way to look into each other's eyes and just remember that we're all human beings, and even if we really disagree, like, we gotta get through this. We can make amends, these stubborn stains will come out in the end. Oh, better angels, unite us all again.
You're married.
Yes.
So does that make it easier or sometimes more difficult to sing together?
Honey,
You want to answer, honey?
I think it makes it easier on the whole. I mean, there's many challenges to doing this thing together. I mean, we'd be kidding ourselves if we said it was all easy.
Yeah, Don, do you want to tell him where he's wrong?
Oh, where should I begin? No, I mean, I think
she'll tell me after, Scott. I'll email
later.
You.
No, I mean, it is such a wild ride to be doing this. We're on tour with our baby, and sometimes I think we are nuts, but it's who we are, and I wouldn't trade it for the world.
Can I ask you about another song? Regrets in the Rear View. A lot of hard-earned wisdom in this song.
Yeah, I feel like that chorus kind of sums up life, my life at least. In the last year, I sort of decided that I wanted to talk about something that I had never talked about before, which is that I'm sober, and I've been sober for 20 years, and I never talked about it. And at my 20-year anniversary of sobriety, I realized that it's time to share it, because maybe someone out there is struggling, and I've had the fortune of living a whole second life and having this beautiful chapter where I got to experience my life sober. And anyway, I just it's something that I'm starting to open up about for the first time, and that to me this song really, you know, it speaks to that as well.
Good for you. And I'm glad you're talking about it. That's what gives people hope.
Thank you.
Eric Lindberg and Donny Zasloff of Nefesh Mountain. Their new album, Beacons, out now. Thank you both very much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
I mean, I feel like celebrating. Is there a song you can play us to celebrate? Any song. I know you got your instruments in there. Whatever.
Let's do World on a String. We can do it. Brand new, but let's try one that I think is very poignant.
She'll make you feel like a child with the world tied to a string. And
this is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon.
When we forget to place our bets on love instead of lies.
Hope, oh how she runs like a horse inside our hearts. She rides for everyone.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Hiscox, committed to helping small businesses protect their dreams. Quotes and information on customized insurance for specific risks are available at Hiscox.com. Hiscox, business insurance experts. From the Cy Sims Foundation, partnering with organizations and people since 1985, working for a better and more just future for all. More information is available at CySimsFoundation.org. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
Fiber Plus Internet is now available in Sandpoint and King Cove. GCI offers high-speed internet in your community at the same plans and pricing as in Anchorage. More information is available at gci.com/internet.
Oh, darling, it's gone past midnight, and won't you do me justice now?
Okay, honey, I will come along now.
Mm-hmm.
Can't you feel the night?
let it be.